And time now for a past champ chat as we welcome in Lucas Glover on this Wednesday edition of Golf Today. Lucas, there was a hard-to-get dinner reservation last night in Philadelphia, U.S. Ryder Cup theme, hosted by Keegan Bradley. You were in attendance. How was the dinner?
It was great. Food was amazing. happy to be there, obviously. Yeah, it was good.
How much is that Ryder Cup on your mind at this point early in the season? I know there's a lot of bonding going on now, but does it come out of its compartment for you at this point of the year? Is it in your sort of the forefront of your mind at all, Lucas?
Yeah, I think with the beginning of the season I had and the way I played, yeah, I jumped up there pretty quick and was getting some chatter about it, and then had some time off and two poor weeks, and now I haven't. And then being there last night kind of got the juices going again a little bit, and been working hard on my game, and that's a goal. So, yeah, it's always in the mind a little bit.
Lucas, I was at Bethpage Black in 2009. I was at Quail in 2011 when you won. You were a great ball striker then. You're a great ball striker now. Three top tens, a couple of tied for third finishes at Pebble and the Players. In how you learned to play this game as a youngster, why are you still so great and consistent at the age of 45, able to compete against the likes of Rory and Scotty?
Well, competing against them could be, depends how you look at it. I've never tried to be somebody I'm not. Never tried to change too much. Always been very pleased with the way I've hit it. And the putting woes are well documented, and feel like I got a lot of that behind me. So it's been fun again to actually go to the golf course, not afraid to play and not afraid to putt and not afraid to make a fool of myself. I do that enough on my own. I don't need my putter to help me. So, it's been a nice resurrection the last couple of years for my career, I would say.
You have a signature event happening this week in Philadelphia, Lucas. Do you have any concerns about the scheduling of signatures? Because we had one the week after the Masters. We have one the week before the PGA. We have another one the week right after the U.S. Open. Does that kind of cadence bother you at all in terms of how you like to prepare for the major championships?
Doesn't really bother me about preparing for the majors. It bothers me how it affects a lot of the other tournaments. It seems like it could, I'm not saying it has or will, but it seems like it could affect a lot of the other tournaments that aren't signature events or aren't majors, because the top players play in just the signatures or just the majors and then handpicking a few. Then, you know, the other tournaments, might be affected. So if that comes to fruition, that will bother me, because I feel like a lot of the markets we go to deserve and need us and want us there and want the best players there.
Well, Erik van Rooyen has joined the course of players who have said they don't really love the signature events in terms of the small number of players in the field. He likes north of 100. You've voiced a similar sentiment as well. Are you guys outliers, or do you feel like you have company and that there are a lot of PGA Tour players who would like to see less signature events in deeper fields on the PGA Tour?
I've been on record as saying I was not a fan of these when they hatched the idea of them. I didn't like them then, and I have been in most of them since they started, and I still don't like them. I've been on the record as saying I don't like cutting to 100 cards, and I still don't. I think it's getting too exclusive, and we're not giving enough opportunity. I've been pretty outspoken about that. I think the majority would agree with that, but unfortunately it doesn't sound like the majority matters. It is what it is at this point, and we're just dealing with it.
Another subject that gets a little sparks flying in the locker room, Lucas, is slow play, and they currently have this rangefinder experiment going on tour. It's already cost one guy an accidental penalty he called on himself last week, Davis Riley. Wouldn't it be easier for the tour to just target the slowest players? Because you guys know who they are. You're out there every week. You see the same guys cause issues all the time.
Yeah, I've been saying that since they hatched this plan of lowering the field sizes and all the things because of pace of play. And it doesn't have to do with the number of players. It has to do with the player or players. Golfers are just slower, and I'm slower because I have to be. But yeah, overall, it's just it's a slower model or a slower game. It's a slower generation. You watch college golf on television or go to an event, and you see why. It's painful. And now with as much money as they're throwing at us, you know, it doesn't really matter if you get fined. So hopefully they'll figure this out. But, you know, in my opinion, it's a year and a half too late. Why didn't we start doing these things 6, 7, 8 months ago, 2 years ago, when we knew this was going to be a problem, instead of just all of a sudden cutting fields or cutting cards? But, you know, like I said, a lot of us don't agree with it, but we're dealing with it.
Lucas, there are a lot of issues that seem to be in flux right now in the professional game. You know, I've covered sports for a long time. I've never felt that golf lent itself to playoffs naturally, maybe like Major League Baseball or even college football, the NBA. And you've talked about the Tour Championship, how the drama is somewhat contrived. Do you have an answer for the FedEx Cup playoffs, a way you would like to see the season conclude that does have a better system, more built in naturally, come to drama?
No, and I don't, and I'm a little upset at myself that I've voiced my frustrations with that without a solution, because I've always felt if you have a complaint, you need to offer a solution, and I don't necessarily have one. Something that's come to mind is maybe reward the regular season with half the bonus purse and then have a playoff for the rest of it or something. I don't have an answer, but what we were doing wasn't working, obviously. The year Scotty had last year, and to be starting only two shots ahead is ridiculous. And the fact that any format where he wasn't the FedEx Cup champion last year before Atlanta started was just, to me, crazy. I mean, he should have been given the trophy the Wednesday night before the tournament started. But I don't know. Gun to my head, I just don't see what's wrong with having a golf tournament with 30 guys there and play four rounds. I don't know. I don't have an answer. I don't think there is one. Playoffs aren't suited for golf, and it's been proven because we've had to change the format so many times.
And that's another of the issues, the housekeeping issues, I guess, within the PGA Tour these days, Lucas. And the Tour does seem to have some kind of momentum in terms of sponsors signing up again, certainly in terms of the TV ratings. Is the Tour in need of a deal with the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia now, or do you think it's just kind of ride the momentum the Tour has and go their own way?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not a businessman. I don't know. I know tournament golf on the PGA Tour, and that's about my expertise, to be fair. But from the people I've talked to that do understand business and the people I've talked to that do understand money, this isn't sustainable. So I don't know how we go forward without another injection of money. But I don't know. I don't have any answers, and I don't pretend to. I can voice my frustrations with how things have been done, and wish for different, or wish for better, or wish for more fair for tour players. And I think that's what I've done, and that's what I've voiced. But I don't know the business side of it enough to know. But I do know that these purses we're playing for aren't sustainable.
Lucas, I want to end where we started. Bethpage Black, you won there in 2009 during that rainy week when Boo Weekly told me there were frogs running up the clubhouse walls. You're on another A.W. Tillinghast design this week. Any echoes, familiarities, things from long ago that you're recognizing this week on this golf course?
It's been so long ago, I hadn't really thought about it. But now that you say that, it's there's a lot of similar bunkering and just the way that some of the holes look. You got an unbelievable mix of par threes and elevation change and some blind tee shots. So yeah, there are some similarities. I would say the greens here are significantly bigger overall. I think Reese Jones touched up Bethpage a little bit, so they're more quadrant style, whereas these are more. They appear to be their old old green complexes, a big slope one way or the other, and then one feature, whether it be a tier or like the our third hole, a par three, just has a little like Hershey Kiss right in the middle of the green, and that's the only feature. They're not overly busy, but they definitely have features, and the greens and the green complexes will be the defense of the golf course.
Lucas, it is always an education when we speak. We appreciate your time. Have a great week at Philadelphia Cricket Club.
Thank you, guys.
Back on golf today, Albert Warren Tilly Tillinghast. One of the most significant designers in the history of the game. He died in 1942 at the age of 66. Today would have been his birthday. Tilly was elected into the World Golf Hall of Fame back in 2014. Speaking of Tillinghast, this week's tour stop, the Truist Championship, is being played on the Wissahickon course at Philadelphia Cricket Club because regular host Quail Hollow is hosting next week's PGA Championship. The Wissahickon course opened in 1922. So let's hear from the players on this week's venue.
You can send it. There's every bunker seems to be about 300 to 310 to carry, which is thankfully fine. There's one bunker on 9 that's 331, but it's down like 10, so it's like 320 equivalent. That's the longest one to try to get over. So in good conditions, I can, if you know it's calm or a little bit of help. But yeah, it's basically open season. Because I go back to Oak Hill a couple of years ago at the PGA, and I tried to play the golf course strategically over the first couple of days, and I just realized that these new renovated old school courses, like the strategy is just hit driver everywhere and then figure it out from there. And that's sort of the strategy of this place this week.
Justin, I'm curious about your approach to the golf course this week. Rory mentioned a couple minutes ago that he noticed some design features that he could carry bunkers at 300 yards and he was going to fully attack with driver. Do you feel the same way about the way you're going to go, or are you going to play more positional?
First off, I would say that's a good strategy for Rory at like every golf course ever made, is just to pull the driver out of the bag unless it's a par three and just hit it, because he hits it better than about anybody in the world. But for the most part, I mean, there is a lot of drivers. The fairways are, they're pretty generous. They're wider than I thought on some holes, but it's super, super wind dependent. We played a different wind the last 3 days, wind direction in the sense of, the 18th hole, for instance, yesterday I hit a driver and a 6-iron in. Today, I mean, I hit this drive as good as I can hit it, and I had 5-wood in. So, like, it can play very differently in terms of some bunkers that are carryable with a certain wind and not others. But I think here it's fairway first, and it's more of a second shot golf course, in my opinion, of where you're leaving it and putting it in the right positions and giving yourself birdie opportunities.
And we're joined now by Dan Miersman, Chief Planning Officer at Philadelphia Cricket Club. Dan, it's great to see you. We just heard the players talking about the golf course. What does it say about the elasticity of Philadelphia Cricket Club that it can host the best players in the world, but also member play as well?
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, on the member play front, you know, you've heard the players say, you know, you can hit driver on nearly most every hole in the par fours and fives. You're not throttled back. You know, and on the best players in the world, the green sites are the strength of the golf course. Very undulated greens. Our green pads go right to the perimeter of the fall-offs near the bunkers. And so it gives you tremendous setup variety in what you want to do, whether you're, you know, setting up for average golfers or you're setting up for the best players in the world like we are this week.
Don, we just heard Rory say there that there isn't a lot of strategy off the tee in the sense that he can carry a lot of the hazards using his driver. He figures it out from there. Is this course going to be able to stand up against a modern power player?
Sorry,
are you expecting the greens will take their pound of flesh out of these guys?
Sorry, I had difficulty hearing you there.
Sorry, we seem to have lost you for a moment there, Dan. I'm curious, we just heard Rory say the driver can bludgeon this golf course to some extent for him. Are you expecting the course will hold up because of the complexity around the greens?
Yeah, no, I do think it will hold up. You know, we have had a little bit of rainfall, so we're a little more receptive than we would optimally like to be. But at the same time, I will tell you, for about 90% of the field, I've been watching a lot of shots. Players are in the landing zone of the bunkers. You know, for somebody like Rory, he can carry some of those. I think I heard one player say how different the 18th hole can play on wind direction, which a lot of our holes can do that. And so, you know, some of those players were in the middle of those bunkers as well. So I think the course is going to hold up fairly well for these guys. And, you know, I also heard the dependency on wind. We're an open site. We have less than 100 trees in the golf course, so the wind often kicks up. And, you know, they're going off the 2-tee start tomorrow. That moves tee times a little bit more in the afternoon when that wind has a chance to blow. And I think we'll see some sporty golf out there tomorrow.
Dan, as you know, the golf course was closed from June 2013 to Memorial Day 2014. What was the goal of the restoration?
Yeah, you know, Damon, we were the first course in the U.S. to ever do a full-scale sympathetic restoration of a classic golf course. And what I mean by that is we closed the Monday after the U.S. Open was at Marion here locally, and our last piece of sod was laid September 28th, and it was all 18 greens were rebuilt, all new bunkers, new irrigation, every piece of sod was redone. And, you know, Keith Foster, our restoration architect, honored A.W. Tillinghast's work, and it's just been amazing. We've hosted championships with each of the governing bodies now of golf, and to have it culminate with the very best players in the world is really special for our membership and really the city of Philadelphia. We have so many great courses in Philadelphia. I know the city takes a lot of great pride in this golf course, and it's great that this golf course is back on the map on this stage.
I know there's a lot of architecture enthusiasts who are looking forward to watching this week, Dan. Is there an appetite at the golf club to host more elite tournament play?
Yeah, you know, our rich sporting heritage is a part of the mission of the club, you know, and whether that is on championship golf, championship rackets, we host national championships here. You know, clearly we're a member-first golf course, but, you know, the course has shown the ability to do that. We have a fantastic membership that gets behind these events on a volunteer basis. I know, you know, sales on the corporate side have been fantastic. You know, charitable contributions to the community have been strong. So, you know, this is something that we're used to doing. I think we do it well, and I think we're capable of hosting anything we want. Additionally, the tournament reroute puts our very best holes in the middle of the golf course near the range. It really creates an amphitheater of golf to where you can build out almost endlessly around those final finishing holes, which are really exciting.
Well, it was certainly great yesterday listening to Maverick McNealy talk about the variety of the par threes, one of which he said he's going to be taking a head cover off a 7-wood to play. That's always great entertainment. Dan, thank you for some time today to explain the golf course to us.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for all you do for golf.
We've seen this sort of cultural excitement and really almost a change in the culture through music with Michael Jackson. We've seen it with the Beatles and Beatlemania, but this was Tiger Mania. I mean, this was sports' equivalent to those huge cultural milestones where society really changed, where people who didn't even care about golf all of a sudden were going to a golf tournament. That kind of change we haven't seen ever. Tiger did that. That's a seismic shift in sports. We'll never see it. 142 straight cuts made. I mean, that stat alone is incredible. No one will ever do that. That's just one. I mean, Tiger's got so many.
Carson Daly on Tiger Woods, and all these years later, the numbers are still absolutely absurd. 20 starts, 9 wins, 3 majors, 4 runner-up finishes. And look at those majors, the U.S. Open, the Open, and the PGA Championship in a row. And to celebrate Tiger in that historic season, ask you to join us on Golf Central. Why? Starting tomorrow and running all weekend long, Johnson Wagner will be traveling around North America with 14 clubs and recreating some of Tiger's majestic shots from the year 2000. And someone who saw a lot of those shots in person joins us now, the great Jaime Diaz. Always great to spend time with you, my friend.
Yes, sir.
What intangibles did Tiger Woods bring to that year? We know he's a great golfer, but there was something else going on.
I think he had a kind of a no-limits kind of mentality that golfers had never really accepted about themselves before. It's like it wasn't really possible to do it all well. And Tiger just had the vision that he could be a complete player, that he could be the first guy to have it all. And I think he was really excited by, you know, redefining what dominance really is. Mm. And he had an incredible work ethic. He had incredible focus. You know, his mom used to talk about, even as a 3-year-old, he had this ability to complete all his little tasks. Whatever he started, you know, he wouldn't just leave it there. He'd finish it. And all those things, I think, you know, carried over into his golf. Obviously, you know, he was not just ability to focus, but also just feel like, you know, a calmness and actually love the pressure moment as, you know, this is going to define me and this is what it's all about and I should embrace it. And, you know, it wasn't anything uncomfortable. He felt more calm in those moments and, you know, the ability to get it done in that, you know, I think I often thought, you know, watching Jordan, Michael Jordan, you know, in his prime, Tiger was growing up with him and, you know, he actually loved Kobe more. But I thought Michael brought that to basketball, you know, the end of the game, how do you finish? And Tiger, I think, really relished that.
This idea of feeling calm, even as he's building pressure upon himself, is intriguing, Haim, because when you look at the cadence of that season, he won Pebble by 2, then he won Bay Hill by 4, the Memorial by 5, the US Open by 15, the Open Championship by 8,
yeah.
Then he won at Firestone by 11. The outlier in there was Bob May actually took him to a playoff at Valhalla in the PGA Championship. The fact that he was able to just keep sailing like a shark with no peripheral vision on a streak like that, what does that actually do to the other rivals that he had at the time that this guy can just keep doing this week in, week out?
I think those guys, you know, kind of innately know who has the most ability and they also understand how someone reacts mentally and they could see it, they could feel it. You know, Ernie Els said after Memorial when he won by 5, it's over. You know, and of course, Ernie had seen it firsthand at the first tournament in Kapalua. Actually, Tiger was beaten a couple of times early in the year. You know, Mickelson got him at Torrey Pines, and Darren Clark beat him in the finals of the match play, and then Hal Sutton beat him, and he finished 5th at the Masters. But then in April, at the end of April, he started messing around with the new Nike Tour accuracy, and it gave him just a little extra edge. And, you know, as you know, the margins are so tight in golf. If you get a superior player gets a little more extra edge, suddenly, instead of just contending all the time, he's actually winning. And that's when he really took off as far as true dominance, a dominance that hadn't been seen, you know, since maybe never.
Yeah, to that point, some would say, well, Jack has more majors, so he's the greatest of all time. But you can make an argument, I would guess, that the year 2000, has anyone ever played golf better than Tiger Woods did that summer?
I think, you know, the designation is, you know, Jack has the greatest record. Tiger played the greatest golf. I think we can forget a little too easily Byron Nelson. He won 18 and 11 straight in 1945. I think the difference is that Tiger was a more dynamic player. And, of course, he had bigger stages, not only with the media, but to do what he did at Pebble and at St. Andrews, two of the greatest, you know, venues.
Yeah.
And Byron, unfortunately, only had one major to play in 1945. The other three had been canceled, and only the PGA was there, and he actually won that one. But, you know, he was more machine-like, very accurate. Of course, I never saw him other than on television, and it was tremendous. But I think Tiger brought, you know, power and precision and this charisma, and it just brought gravitas to golf that hadn't been there before.
There's so many memorable moments from that year, and we're seeing some of them here. But, you know, there was that 6-iron from the fairway bunker in Canada. There was the hole-out at Pebble, this moment here, in the playoff with Bob May at Valhalla. Is there one moment, Jaime, in that 2000 season that even now, a quarter century later, is still fresh in your mind?
Yes, because he felt like he hit the ball his very, very best of his career at St. Andrews and winning the British Open by 8 strokes. Even though he won by 15 at Pebble, that was an incredible putting exhibition. He hit it great, but he hit it better at St. Andrews. And the shot that he loved the most, and to see it, you can sort of almost see him relishing it as he's flying through the air, because he didn't really twirl it. He just kind of stood there and said, okay, that's as good as I can do. It was a 3-wood second shot on the 14th, a par 5, called long over hell bunker. And he had 272 into the green. Here it is. There's left to right wind. And he told Steve Williams, is that the one you're talking about? You know, because he said, let's see it. You know, let's see the best shot. And he did. He just put it purely where he was aiming at the television tower. You could see the town in the background. It was just a great stage. And he pulled it off, and you could feel like, and they gave him a six-shot lead at that point with a round to go. And it was kind of a closing shot in a way. It was like, I've got it this week, and there it is, you know.
I was covering the Lakers-Pacers NBA championship in 2000 when Tiger won at Pebble by 15. Yeah. And I said, I'm going to go watch Tiger win the Open.
Right.
I'm going to go buy tickets to St. Andrews, stay in the dorm. I was told by Jeff Williams, the golf writer, and Art Spander, And it was as if I was going to watch a show. And Carson Daly talked about it. It's like you're going to see Michael Jackson. I was not going to watch the Open. Right. I was going to watch Tiger Woods complete the career. Like, it was inevitable. What right. other athletes could you say that about, especially in a game with a dimpled ball and a crooked stick?
And where the winning ratio is percentage is less than any other area. Yeah. You could go say that about a dominant tennis player. I'm going to go see Djokovic win another Grand Slam. But to connect the two, I'm going to go see Tiger. No, I'm not going to see Tiger win.
Yeah.
You know, because that's just the inevitable part of it. Yeah. And, yeah, I think that's why Tiger exists in people's mind as in a way that golfers would never imagine before. He transcended the difficulty of the game for a moment there. Mm. It wasn't for long. It was really only 4 months that he was really, truly at his peak. And it was hard to sustain, obviously. And he did win the Tiger Slam the next year. But I think those 4 months between, you know, May and I guess it ended at Canada with that 6-iron. And he won by 11 at Firestone. All those things just made it seem like when he's half on, he's just so much better than everybody. And, you know, it wasn't like he's just on a hot streak. No, he's just better. And he didn't really have to play his best. But then when he did, it was double-digit victories. By the way, I want to say about Nelson, he won 4 times net in 1945 by double digits. So he was dominant, too, just in a different way. Yeah.
Well, Tiger's almost 50, turns 50 at the end of this year. He's out injured. Is it likely in your mind now that we're much more apt to see him on the senior tour than we are on the regular tour going forward?
I think he will, because I think he really still loves golf, and I think he still relishes the challenge. And I think
think he wants to beat up on those guys?
Yeah, and he misses it. I think he misses the thing he did best and the thing that gave him so much meaning for so long. I think it still does give him meaning. He does have a record to kind of chase, which is the most USGA championships. If he wins the senior open, he'd have 10. More than Bobby Jones, who has 9. So that's kind of the outward record. But I think he just innately loves it and the joy of it and the challenge of it. And it's you know, unfortunately, a lot of his physical abilities have been taken. But I still think he finds it intriguing to still find a way because he still is quite, you know, able. Yeah. It just he's lost a little speed. He's lost a little flexibility. But I think the challenge of still hitting great golf shots, even with that handicap, almost makes it an extra incentive to show that he can still do it.
It's fun to look back at the year 2000, especially for guys of our vintage. I mean, no one does it better than you. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Appreciate Thanks, it. Guys.
Time now for a past champ chat. We welcome in the two-time Truist champion, Max Homa, into golf today. Great to see you, Max. You're a California guy. I'm a California guy. We don't get to see Philly Cricket Club every day. What kind of golf course are we getting this week?
Oh man, yeah, it's awesome. I wish they made them like this these days. We got the soft weather, the rain, so it make the course a little bit soft, so the scores might not indicate just how great this place is. But if you made the rough high, brought the fairways in a little bit, the greens are so cool. It's not overly long. You got to think about it a lot. It's what golf should be.
Max, you've won this tournament on 2 different courses. You now find yourself at yet another new golf course. Is it tough to summon the positive mojo from your past record in this tournament because you are at a different venue?
Yeah. I mean, they even changed the name of the event. So next week I'll feel some positive mojo. But I guess one knock on Rory now that he's completed the Grand Slam is he's only ever won this event at Quail Hollow. I've branched out a little bit, so maybe I got a leg up on him when it's a new course. But no positive mojo here, but I really like the golf course, and this event's been good to me.
Well, you're playing some really good golf. Loved your T12 at the Masters Tournament, and it followed a tough stretch of golf for you. So I'm curious, did something that Augusta National bring out of your game, or do you just feel like your game is starting to come together a little bit?
A little bit now, because the next week I played terrible. I think Augusta, I just did a really good job of managing what I had. It fed into kind of how my season's gone. My irons have been good the last couple months. Short game's been great. I didn't drive it well, but at Augusta, you don't necessarily have to drive it amazing. So I do think that helped quite a bit. But we've made the last 2 weeks being off, made a bunch of tweaks and to some setup stuff, some setting stuff. So I do feel a lot better, but the Masters definitely felt kind of like one of those random good weeks. I got dubbed for a while that I couldn't play well in majors. Now it seems like I only play well in majors. So really flipped the narrative on everybody. But no, that week kind of just came out of left field in my head. Like I said, I played poorly the next week, but my game does feel better. The last, you know, two and a half days here has been nice. Last week at home was good. So hoping this is kind of the turning point to start playing some real good golf.
Do you feel as though the issues have been more mechanical or confidence related, Max, or do those two things go hand in hand every week out there on tour?
That's a great question. I think they are a bit hand in hand. It's been more mechanical. It just doesn't feel the same when I get under pressure on a Thursday, you know, when it really matters. It doesn't have the same flow. Something's been off, and it just feels like we've been chasing it. So I haven't had the same feel or thought for weeks at a time. Week and a half ago, I watched like 2 hours of my own YouTube swings from, you know, weeks I play well, especially Riviera when I got second, and I just tried to find what in there I should be like the staple of my swing. So I think with some time here, it feels kind of like I was telling my coach John the other day, it feels like home a little bit. I feel like I know the misses a little bit, and I think knowing the misses, that's how your confidence starts to go with it, to your question. So I'm definitely optimistic, and it feels a lot more repeatable, and it feels more like my golf swing. But it's just been, you know, swing changes are hard. I was stuck in a really weird spot. Golf club's been really behind me, so just been a long time of trying to get it back in front of me. And then you're playing against the best players in the world on some hard golf courses. It's not exactly the place to feel comfy doing that, so I've been exposed quite a few times. But I work hard, man, so I'm waiting for that hard work to pay off.
Well, you work extremely hard. You're one of the hardest workers out there. That's your reputation. You've had some incredible highs and some big-time lows as well. Does the fact that you've emerged from some depths in this game give you a sense of calm even when you are struggling a little bit, knowing you've been out and gotten out of trouble before?
No, I think the secret to it is I'm never calm. I'm always trying to get better, work on stuff. It's probably got me in trouble at times, but now I'm always, you know, leaving no stone unturned. That's kind of just how my brain unfortunately works. It won't turn off. But I think the benefit to that in a time like this is I'll just keep working. I leave some days, I leave the golf course despondent and don't ever want to play again. And then somehow wake up in the morning with this crazy excitement to go figure it out. So I think that'll bode well. And, you know, I'd love to be Scottie Scheffler and play well every week. It'd be a lot better than what I'm doing. But I do know that when this thing clicks and I get a win and start to play great again, and it'll just feel, you know, even better than it did, you know, 23 when I was playing great. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to that. And, yeah, like I said, the game will kind of take you on a roller coaster. But for some reason, I wake up excited to try it again the next day. So I think that's the beauty of this game.
Speaking of the ability to turn your mind off, Max, you gained a reputation for engaging fans on social media, which can be a tough place to hang out even when things are going well, and pretty lousy when things aren't going well. You haven't posted on X in 3 months. Have you made a conscious decision to just step back from that environment?
Oh, yeah, I don't go on that app anymore. That app is, like you said it best, even when you're doing well, people think you stink. I've read stuff about Rory McIlroy not being a good closer on that app, which is hilarious. He's won 20-something times in every major. So it's not a good place for your mental mentals. It's an unhealthy spot. So no, I have not been on there. Still enjoy TikTok. I feel like the generation's a bit younger. They're still nice. I haven't been jaded by the world yet. So I've enjoyed that one. Social media is kind of just a part of our life when you grow up. You know, you grew up in the 90s and it started MySpace, and everyone's just been on the internet. So trying to take a step back somewhere. I still got my vices in it, but not on X. Not on X, the everything app. I'm not about that place anymore.
What's been the result? What's life been like without X over the last 3 months? In a better place, happier person?
I mean, I just don't get people telling me how bad I am as often, so that's cool. I do a lot more crosswords on the New York Times app, getting real good at Wordle. The mini crosswords, the bane of my existence, trying to get good at that. So I feel like I'm moving on. I'm still on my phone. I'm just doing some other stuff. So, yeah, it's just nice when you don't have 500 people every month telling you you're not very good at golf when you kind of know you're not playing well. Gets a bit redundant.
The next week, you go back to Quail Hollow for a major championship, Max. You do have good vibes there. You've won there. Obviously, you've had this kind of up and down thing with the confidence. Does it help you to go to a place like Quail Hollow for a major when you, you know you can play that golf course better than anyone else?
Yeah, I'm really excited to go back there. That was my last top 10 I've had. I played well there in the President's Cup. I've played well there, obviously, in the event, in the tour event. So it is, and you know, with some of the, like, the swing changes and stuff, as we talked about before, like, the misses are, like, where confidence kind of comes from, like, knowing where to miss it, knowing where I will tend to miss it. And as the golf swing's gotten a bit more, I got more understanding of it. Getting to go to a golf course where you know you play well not only boosts kind of your morale about the place, but I also feel like I know it really well. I know what you need to do to play well there. I know where you need to leave it. I know where you need to not miss it. And I know certain shots that I can, you know, work on at home in prep and in the lead up to it. So I think that, like, all those things are always very helpful. Last year I wasn't playing a whole lot better than I am now, and I went out there and I think I got seventh or eighth. So it's just a place that, like, I see well, and again, just knowing a place and knowing that you can play it helps, especially when you're struggling a little bit.
Max, golf can take you to some amazing places. At the end of 2023, it took you to South Africa. You and Lacey went on a safari with the Thomases. A lot different trip than the Grand Canyon or the Eiffel Tower. I've been on safari, Kenya, Zimbabwe, Botswana. What's the greatest thing about a safari vacation?
Man, that's a good question. I said when you're out there, it looks fake, but it's the realest place I've ever been. You know, it's as pure as it gets. Also, at that time, we had a one-year-old or so, and the 30 hours of travel without a child was pretty cool. I watched a lot of movies. I don't really get to watch TV anymore, so that was kind of fun. But yeah, it's just very realist. I was kind of scared to do it, and it's oddly peaceful, you know? You get to watch... you know, the circle of life, you just realize there's a lot more out there than just golf and working and all those things. So we're very lucky. I tell anybody, if you have the good fortune to be able to take a week off and travel across the world to go see it, then you should do it, because I think it puts a lot of things in perspective. It's fun, and we got to go with, you know, two of our favorite people in the world, Jill and Justin. So it was a special trip.
I can attest it's peaceful until you can hear an elephant clomping around outside your tent in the dead of night, and then suddenly it doesn't feel so peaceful.
Those things
point.
Are scary, brother. Those things, I went in there, as elephant was my favorite animal. I'm more terrified of them than any of the other animals. So those things are smart, and they are massive, and when they want to go somewhere, you better not be in the way.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
The first night, I was scared of the lions, and I didn't want to see any, but by the end of the trip, I couldn't wait to see the lions. You're right, it becomes this peaceful thing, and your blood pressure drops about 20 or 30. Hey, Max, we appreciate your time and your honesty as always. You're not on X anymore. I'm gonna look for you on TikTok. Have a great week, pal.
Thank you to the Amens. I appreciate you guys having me.
Well, the Ryder Cup comes to Bethpage Black September 26th to the 28th. And how about this, folks? Today, the PGA of America announcing the launch of the People's Perk, a Ryder Cup ticket giveaway. Over the next 5 months, complimentary Ryder Cup tickets will be distributed to New York residents through a series of surprise moments at Bethpage Black, as well as several public golf courses on Long Island and New York City Metro. A total of 3,000 tickets were reserved to be shared, with 500 tickets available each day, Tuesday through Sunday of Ryder Cup week. With more on today's news, we are joined by Brian Carnes, 2025 Ryder Cup Championship Director. Brian, thanks so much for hopping on. 3,000 complimentary tickets. How did this idea come to pass?
Well, it's really been a long time in the making. And when we were going through all of the strategy, all of the really comprehensive ticket planning, essentially this time last year, I mean, it was, you know, maybe 6 to 8 months of planning that went into that. We knew in the back of our mind that one of the biggest challenges was just going to be access relative to the number of people that were interested in tickets. And so when you look at maybe 500,000 plus people that we were expecting to register and try to get Ryder Cup tickets, we knew that a couple of things were going to make it potentially challenging for locals to even be able to buy them. And that was with a large number of those people coming from outside of the area. And so there was a real concern on our end that those individuals, after we went through our random selection and the process that we went to sell tickets this last fall, there wouldn't be, you know, or people would be shut out that were local. And so we had this plan in place. We had these 3,000 tickets reserved. We just didn't know exactly how we were going to roll that out, how we were going to execute it. And so really the last 6-8 months, we've put a lot of time and effort collaborating with the Metropolitan New York section, the folks at state parks, to really do everything in our power to put tickets in the hands of the true New Yorker local golfers, the people that, again, were left out because the lottery, they didn't get selected. And so we feel like we've landed on this incredible program that kicked off on opening day at Bethpage. And I think it's really just going to speak to the spirit of Bethpage, what makes that place special, and certainly the PGA of America, you know, getting those folks that are every day out there grinding municipal courses. It's such a powerful message to help tell, and the reaction so far has just been incredible.
Are there mechanisms in place, Brian, to make sure that these tickets are used by the people that you're intending them to be used by and that they don't end up in the hands of brokers or scalpers?
Yeah, and Amy, one of the things I think that we really, as we drill down on this, to try to eliminate that was to almost do it this grassroots way, which it's as old school as it is to think, instead of trying to set up some registration and we'll verify all this, we said, why don't we just go out and meet people? Why don't we just have a grassroots sort of program where we're meeting people where they are, and A, that allows us to obviously put the tickets in the hands, put these vouchers in the hands of people that we know are the all sort of the end users. And obviously there's some mechanisms we can use to make those tickets non-transferable, so somebody couldn't immediately take them. Once you get that ticket transferred to your account, you're unable to transfer it out or put it on the market to resell. So there are some of those things in place. But again, so far, and if you watch the video that our social team had today from the opening day, I don't think any of the people that are receiving these tickets have any interest in doing anything other than using them. And that's what's been really cool about it. And again, it's an old school approach to say, let's just go out to golf courses. There's obviously, you know, some personnel bandwidth that's required to do it. But it just felt like this is the way we can cut through everything that you just outlined in terms of the potential risk that's misused by just putting them in the hands of people that we know are going to come out and are going to take advantage of this opportunity.
Brian, 3,000 is a lot of tickets, but as the former golf writer of the New York Times, I can tell you the New York metropolitan region is vast. We're talking large swaths of land, upper-level golf courses, the hardscrabble muni. How did you even begin to decide, okay, this golf course gets it, this person does, this person maybe gets five? Like, how do you even begin that process in such a large, large area?
That's really where the Metropolitan PGA section came into play. You know, they're our conduit to every golf course in this market. And Jeff Voorhees, who's the executive director, and the crew that he has, really helped us drill down. And you know, naturally, Bethpage is where we started. And Damon, I've only been in New York the last couple of years, but it's amazing how highly regarded Bethpage is. And even as, you know, we've been out more and more at the golf course as the build started, you know, seeing the people lugging their clubs to the subway, jumping on the train, it's an incredible thing that I think, unless you've been here and lived here and watched people, you know, spend 90 minutes just getting to a golf facility, I think it's hard to really understand that passion. But we started there, and that's part of what we do really with all of our championships is we listen to the community, we get embedded with leadership, with community groups, with a lot of these PGA golf professionals, and we sort of quietly put that out there and said, hey, this is the program, you know, who wants to be involved? And we certainly understand that, you know, 3,000 tickets, to your point, there's more golfers in the New York area that would love this than we have tickets for. But we felt like it was something that just needed to happen and something that we from the beginning felt like this was our way to give back. So many of these, you know, championships that we run and certainly the Ryder Cup, there's a lot of cut and paste, and the Ryder Cup in Minneapolis and Whistling Straits is going to look the same as this. But then there's a fair amount and maybe 10 or 15% of what we do that we really gear towards the local community, or we gear towards the market that we're in. You know, that's why when we did the captain's announcement, we did it in New York City at the NASDAQ. We're doing a fan activation in Manhattan in addition to everything we're doing on Long Island. So all those things really just come to play in these sort of programs. And this is the one that we felt like we can hit it out of the park with this. We took our time to make sure that we could do it the right way. And again, based on just the first time giving this away, giving these tickets away 3 or 4 weeks ago, we can't wait to do this throughout the course of the summer and really give people that are worthy of these tickets, whether it's local golfers, it's first responders and other real key community groups, the chance to come out and experience what we feel like is the most magical event in all sports.
The barrier to access to the Ryder Cup isn't just the lottery system for tickets, Brian. It was also the cost at almost $1,000 per ticket during the tournament days. Is this a reaction from the PGA of America to the criticism for the ticket pricing?
No, I don't think so in any way, shape, or form, because, and again, I say this as someone who was there from the beginning of all this. We had always thought about this. And again, we wanted to do it in the right way. And so that's why we got through the ticketing thing and certainly have understood, you know, some of the concerns around that. But I think that the sales and how quickly those tickets went sort of validated where we landed on those, you know, $660 tickets for the competition rounds. But this was always separate from that. I mean, there's always a component of what we do, whether it's charitable tickets, it's these sort of community programs that, again, we don't go into each one, and there's not going to be necessarily a cut and paste people's perk for the next Ryder Cup. We might go into Minneapolis and Chaska, Minnesota, and say this is actually the program that can have the most impact. And so that's where, you know, the time, the patience that goes into that, it's always a factor. Again, we felt like we wanted to do this right. And everything about this Ryder Cup has been with, you know, this is a rare opportunity to do, you know, event on maybe the biggest platform in the entire planet, but also at one of the most special golf courses, in the entire United States for everything it represents. And so, no, this was in our mind very much, something that was going to happen regardless of if, you know, nobody had said anything about the ticket pricing.
Well, if it was always part of the plan, Brian, why wasn't it announced 6 months ago when the ticket prices were announced? Because when you announce it 6 months later, it starts to look like a reaction to the criticism over the ticket pricing.
Yeah, we had wanted to use it as a way to build excitement throughout the course of the summer. I mean, that was really it. Obviously, we have a cadence to everything we do. And so we wanted to make sure that, you know, it wasn't something that people held off or didn't buy tickets because, and then there was disappointment. So, you know, obviously if you stack it together, then someone maybe says, well, I won't register, I won't buy. So we felt like this was always going to be something that was going to be authentic to what we had planned for the summer of 2025 as we built up excitement. That's obviously a part of my job is to make sure the local market, even a place like New York City, is sort of building that momentum towards the Ryder Cup. And so we wanted to have that be a part of, again, something that it wasn't reactionary. And I would say that, you know, if we were truly reactionary, we might have done it, you know, a month afterwards, because that was already in place. And, you know, and there would have been very easy to say, look, we've got this plan in place. We were targeting, you know, next spring. Let's just get it out because it's reactionary. But then I think we just looked inside and said, look, this is a great program that we're really proud of. It doesn't need to be forced. When we get there, we'll roll it out in a way that we feel really proud of. And that's why we're so excited to get it out there today.
Brian, speaking of authentic, New York fans are authentic. They're passionate. They're loud. They're protagonists. You will hear their voice, whatever the sport is and the sporting event they attend. How do you capitalize on the excitement and the noise that we all expect, but also have that balance, crowd control, maybe the ropes pushed back a little farther away from the fairways?
It's a great question. And, you know, I think New York fans across all sports are unbelievable. And, you know, being in a city throughout the last 2 years and, you know, even like right now with the Knicks in the playoffs, it's palpable, the energy in the city. I think what I've also learned, though, is that when it comes to golf, these people, most of the fans are incredibly educated. They know what's going on. And so I think that there's going to be a mix of things. One, that we're going to trust that New York golf fans are going to be respectful. They're going to know that, you know, there are moments that you can cheer for your team and maybe even celebrate a missed putt by your opponents if you're getting a point. But just in case, we will have the full support of New York State Police. We've got, you know, a pretty intensive security plan that we hope we don't have to implement. We certainly feel like fans and fans oftentimes in that environment too are self-policing. And I've seen that happen at Ryder Cups in the past where you might get someone that steps out of line, says something that's maybe inappropriate. And oftentimes before we even get some security there to handle it, there's fans that are pointing that person out because I think people just understand how special that environment is and how important it is that you kind of maintain that level of integrity. But, you know, so much of what we do is planning for every possible scenario, assume best intentions. We hope that everything goes according to plan. And I'm certainly confident that New York golf fans are going to be fantastic. And I think the other part is, you know, when you look at where people are coming from, yes, there is a good contingent and certainly this, the People's Perk is helping to put more Bethpage and Long Island folks out there. There are people coming from all over the world to this event. I mean, there's 10 to 15% of our ticket buyers were European. So I think as much it is a New York, there's people from all over the world that are going to be there and I think make up that crowd.
It's a great unknown. That's part of the excitement. Brian, thanks so much for joining us. We're all looking forward to the fall. We appreciate it.
All right. Appreciate you guys. Thank you.